A figure lurched out of the foam, dripping brown bubbles. "Who goes there?" said Ridcully.
"Ah, yes. Did anyone get the number of that ox-cart? Another doughnut, if you'd be so good,"
said the figure brightly, and fell over into the froth.
"That sounded like the bursar to me," said Ridcully.
"Come along, lad. It's only bubbles." He strode into the foam. After a moment's hesitation, Ponder realized that the honour of young wizardry was at stake, and pushed his way in behind him. Almost immediately, he bumped into someone in the fog of bubbles.
Hello.
Who's that?
It's me, Stibbons. I've come to rescue you.
Good. Which way is out? There were some explosions somewhere in the coffee cloud, and a popping noise. Ponder blinked. The level of bubbles was sinking. Various pointy hats appeared like drowned logs in a drying lake. Ridcully waded over, coffee froth dripping from his hat.
"Something bloody stupid's been going on here," he said, "and I'm going to wait quite patiently until the Dean owns up."
"I don't see why you should assume it was me," muttered a coffee-coloured column.
"Well, who was it then?" "The Dean said the coffee ought to be frothy," said a mound of foam of a senior Wranglish persuasion. "And he did some simple magic, and I rather think we got carried away."
"Ah, so it was you, Dean."
"Yes, all right, but only by coincidence," said the Dean testily.
"Out of here, all of you," said Ridcully. "Back to the university this minute."
"I mean, I don't see why you should assume it's my fault, just because sometimes it might happen to be me who..."
The froth had sunk a bit more, to reveal a pair of eyes under a dwarfish helmet.
"Excuse me," said a voice still under the bubbles, "but who's going to pay for all this? That's $4, thank you very much."
"The bursar's got the money," said Ridcully quickly.
"Not any more," said the senior wrangler. "He bought 17 doughnuts."
"Sugar?" said Ridcully. "You let him eat sugar? You know that makes him, you know, a bit funny. Mrs. Whitlow said she'd give notice if we let him get anywhere near sugar again."
He herded the damp wizards towards the door.
"All right, my good man, you can trust us. We're wizards. I shall have some money sent round in the morning." "Eh, you expect me to believe that, do you?" said the dwarf.
It had been a long night. Ridcully turned and waved his hand at the wall. There was a crackle of octarine fire, and the words, "I owe you $4, burned themselves into the stone.
"Oh, right you are, then. No problem there," said the dwarf, ducking back into the froth.
"I shouldn't think Mrs. Whitlow is going to worry," said the lecturer in recent rooms as they squelched through the night. "I saw her and some of the maids at the concert. You know, the kitchen girls, Molly, Polly and Dolly. They were screaming."
"I didn't think the music was that bad," said Ridcully.
"No, not in pain. I wouldn't say that," said the lecturer in recent rooms, beginning to go red. "But when the young man was waggling his hips like that..."
"He definitely looks elvish to me," said Ridcully.
I think she threw some of her under things on to the stage."
This silenced even Ridcully, at least for a while. Every wizard was suddenly busy with his own private thoughts.
"What? Mrs. Whitlow?"
the Chair of Indefinite Studies began.
"Yes."
I
think so."
Ridcully had once seen Mrs. Whitlow's washing line. He'd been impressed. He'd never believed there was so much pink elastic in the world.
"What, really?
Said the Dean, his voice sounding as though it was coming from a long way away.
I'm pretty sure."
"Sounds dangerous to me," said Ridcully briskly. "Could do someone a serious injury. Now then, you lot, back to the university, right now for cold baths all round."
"Really?
Said the Chair of Indefinite Studies. Somehow, none of them felt able to leave the idea alone.
"Make yourself useful and find the bursar," snapped Ridcully.
"And I'd have you lot up in front of the university authorities first thing in the morning if it wasn't for the fact that you are the university authorities." Foul old Ron, professional maniac and one of Ankh-Morpork's most industrious beggars, blinked in the gloom. Lord Vetinari had excellent night vision, and unfortunately, a well-developed sense of smell.
"And then what happened?"
he said, trying to keep his face turned away from the beggar. Because the fact was that although in actual size foul old Ron was a small hunched man in a huge grubby overcoat, in smell he filled the world. In fact, foul old Ron was a physical schizophrenic. There was foul old Ron, and there was the smell of foul old Ron, which had obviously developed over the years to such an extent that it had a distinct personality. Anyone could have a smell that lingered long after they'd gone somewhere else, but the smell of foul old Ron could actually arrive somewhere several minutes before he did, in order to spread out and get comfortable before he arrived. It had evolved into something so striking that it was no longer perceived with the nose, which shut down instantly in self-defence. People could tell that foul old Ron was approaching by the way their earwax started to melt.
Wrong side out, I told him, bugger him.
The patrician waited. With foul old Ron, you had to allow time for his wandering mind to get into the same vicinity as his tongue.
Spying on me with magic. I told him, bean soup, see here. And then everyone was dancing, you see. And then afterwards there were two of the wizards in the street, and one of them was going on about catching the music in a box. And Mr. Dibbler was interested, and then the coffee house exploded, and they all went back to the university, bugger it. Bugger 'em, bugger it, see if I don't.
The coffee house exploded, did it?
Frothy coffee all over the place, Your Honour, bugger it.
Yes, and so on, said the patrician, waving a thin hand. And that's all you can tell me?
Well, bugger, baby.
Foul old Ron caught the patrician's eye and got a grip on himself. Even in his own highly individualized sanity, he could tell when not to punish his threadbare luck. His smell wandered around the room, reading documents and examining the pictures.
They say, he said, that he drives all the women mad.
He leaned forward. The patrician leaned back.
They say, after he moved his hips like that, Mrs. Whitlow threw her what's-names onto the stage.
The patrician raised an eyebrow.
What's-names?
You know.
Foul old Ron moved his hands vaguely in the air.
A pair of pillowcases?
Mm-mm.
Two sacks of flour? Some very baggy trousers? Oh,
I see.
My word.
Were there any casualties?
Dunno, Your Honour, but there's something I do know.
Yes?
Cumbling Michael says, Your Honour, sometimes pays for information.
Yes, I know. I can't imagine how these rumours get about, said the patrician, getting up and opening a window. I shall have something done about it. Once again, foul old Ron reminded himself that while he was probably insane, he definitely wasn't as mad as all that.
Only I've got this, Your Honour,
he said, pulling something out of the horrible recesses of his clothing.
It says writing on it, Your Honour.
It was a poster in glowing primary colours. It couldn't have been very old, but an hour or two as foul old Ron's chest warmer had aged it considerably. The patrician unfolded it with a pair of tweezers.
Them's the pictures of the music players,
said Foul Old Ron, helpfully.
And that's writing. And then there's more writing. There, look. Mr. Dibbler had Chalky the Troll run him off just now, but I nipped in after and threatened to breathe on everyone, lest they give me one.
"I'm sure that worked famously," said the patrician. He lit a candle and read the poster carefully. In the presence of foul old Ron, all candles burned with a blue edge to the flame. "Free festival of music with rocks in it," he said.
That's where you don't have to pay to go in,"
said foul old Ron helpfully.
"Bugger 'em, yeah. Buggery."
Lord Vetinari read on. "In Hyde Park, next Wednesday. Well, well, a public open space, of course. I wonder if there'll be many people there."
"Lots, Your Honour. There was hundreds couldn't get into the cavern."
"And the band looks like that, do they?" said Lord Vetinari, "scowling like that."
"Sweating most of the time, I saw them," said foul old Ron.
"Be there or be a rectangular thing," said the patrician. "This is some sort of occult code, do you think?"
"Couldn't say, Your Honour," said foul old Ron. My brain, it goes all slow when I'm thirsty."
"They are totally unable to be seen, and a longy way out," said Lord Vetinari solemnly. He looked up. "Oh, I am sorry," he said. "I'm sure I can find someone to give you a cool, refreshing drink." Foul old Ron coughed. It had sounded like a perfectly sincere offer, but somehow he was suddenly not at all thirsty.
"Don't let me keep you, then. Thank you so very much," said Lord Vetinari.
"Yes?" "Nothing."
"Very good." When Ron had buggerummed down the stairs, the patrician tapped his pen thoughtfully on the paper and stared at the wall. The pen kept bouncing on the word "free." Finally, he rang a small bell. A young clerk put his head round the door. "Ah, Drumnot," said Lord Vetinari. "Just go and tell the head of the Musicians' Guild he wants a word with me, will you?"
"Mr. Cleet is already in the waiting room, Your Lordship," said the clerk.
"Ah, does he by any chance have some kind of poster with him?"
"Yes, Your Lordship."
"And is he very angry?"
"This is very much the case, Your Lordship. It's about some festival. He insists you have it stopped."
"Dear me."
"And he demands that you see him instantly."
"Ah. Then leave him for, say, 20 minutes, then show him up."
"Yes, Your Lordship. He keeps saying that he wants to know what you are doing about it."
"Good. Good. Then I can ask him the same question." The patrician sat back. "Si non confectus, non reficiat." That was the motto of the Vetinaris. Everything worked if you just let it happen. He picked up a stack of sheet music and began to listen to Salami's Prelude to a Nocturne on a Theme by Bubbler. After a while, he looked up.
"Don't hesitate to leave," he snapped.
The smell slunk away.
"Squeak!"
"Don't be stupid. All I did was frighten them off. It's not as though I hurt them. What's the good of having the power if you can't use it?"
The death of rats put his nose in his paws. It was a lot easier with rats. Rats had featured largely in the history of Ankh-Morpork. Shortly before the patrician came to power, there was a terrible plague of rats. The city council countered it by offering 20 pence for every rat tail. This did, for a week or two, reduce the number of rats, and then people were suddenly queuing up with tails. The city treasury was being drained, and no one seemed to be doing much work. And there still seemed to be a lot of rats around. Lord Vetinari had listened carefully while the problem was explained, and had solved the thing with one memorable phrase, which said a lot about him, about the folly of bounty offers, and about the natural instinct of Ankh-Morporkians in any situation involving money. "Tax the rat farms." C.M.O.T. Dibbler often did without sleep, too. He generally had to meet Chalky at night. Chalky was a large troll, but tended to dry up and flake in daylight.
Other trolls looked down on him because he came from a sedimentary family and was therefore a very low-class troll indeed. He didn't mind. He was a very amiable character. He did odd jobs for people who needed something unusual in a hurry and without entanglements and who had clinking money. And this job was pretty odd.
Just boxes, he said. With lids, said Dibbler, like this one I've made, and a bit of wire stretched inside.
Some people would have said why, or what for, but Chalky didn't make his money like that. He picked up the box and turned it this way and that.
How many?
He said.
Just 10 to start with, said Dibbler, but I think there'll be more later. Lots and lots more. How many is 10?
Said the troll. Dibbler held up both hands, fingers extended.
I'll do them for $2, said Chalky.
You want me to cut me own throat?
$2.
Dollar each for these and $1.50 for the next batch.
$2. All right. $2 each. That's $10 the lot, right? Right. And that is cutting me own throat.
Chalky tossed the box aside. It bounced on the floor and the lid came off. Sometime later, a small greyish-brown mongrel dog, on the prowl for anything edible, limped into the workshop and sat peering into the box for a while. Then it felt a bit of an idiot and wandered off. Ridcully hammered on the door of the high-energy magic building as the city clocks were striking 2. He was supporting Ponder Stibbons, who was asleep on his feet. Ridcully was not a quick thinker, but he always got there eventually. The door opened, and Skaz's hair appeared.
"Are you facing me?" said Ridcully.
Yes, Arch-Chancellor."
"Let us in, then. The dew's soaking through me boots."
Ridcully looked around as he helped Ponder in.
"Wish I knew what it was that keeps you lads working all hours," he said. "I never found magic that interesting when I was a lad. Go and fetch some coffee for Mr. Stibbons here, will you? And then get your friends."
Skaz bustled off, and Ridcully was left alone, except for the slumbering Ponder.
"What is it they do?"
he said. He never really tried to find out. Skaz had been working at a long bench by one wall. At least he recognised the little wooden disc. There were small oblong stones ranged on it in a couple of concentric circles, and a candle lantern positioned on a swivelling arm so that it could be moved anywhere around the circumference. It was a travelling computer for druids, a sort of portable stone circle, something they called a knee-top. The bursar had sent off for one once. It had said, "For the priest in a hurry," on the box. He'd never been able to make it work properly, and now it was used as a doorstop. Ridcully couldn't see what they had to do with magic. After all, it wasn't much more than a calendar, and you could get a perfectly good calendar for 8p. Rather more puzzling was the huge array of glass tubes behind it. That was where Skaz had been working. There was a litter of bent glassware and jars and bits of cardboard where the student had been sitting. The tubing seemed to be alive. Ridcully leaned forward. It was full of ants. They scuttled along the tubing and through complex little spirals in their thousands. In the silence of the room, their bodies made a faint, continuous rustling. There was a slot level with the Arch-Chancellor's eyes. The word "In" was written on a piece of paper that had been pasted onto the glass, and on the bench was an oblong of card which looked just the right shape to go into the slot. It had round holes punched in it. There were 2 round holes, then a whole pattern of round holes, and then a further 2 holes. On it, in pencil, someone had scribbled 2 times 2. Ridcully was the kind of man who'd push any lever just to see what it did. He put the card in the obvious slot. There was an immediate change in the rustling. Ants trailed in their busy way through the tubing. Some of them appeared to be carrying seeds. There was a small dull sound, and a card dropped out of the other end of the glass maze. It had 4 holes in it. Ridcully was still staring at it when Ponder came up behind him, rubbing his eyes.
"It's our ant counter," he said.
2 plus 2 equals 4, said Ridcully.
"Well, well, I never knew that. It can do other sums as well."
"Are you telling me ants can count?"
"Oh, no, not individual ants. It's a bit hard to explain. The holes in the cards, you see, block up some tubes and let them through others, and,"
Ponder sighed,
"we think it might be able to do other things."
"Like what?"
Rid Cully demanded.
Well, that's what we're trying to find out.
You're trying to find out?
Who built it? Skaz.
And now you're trying to find out what it does.
Well, we think it might be able to do quite complicated maths if we can get enough bugs in it.
Ants were still bustling around the enormous crystalline structure.
Had a rat thingy or a gerbil or something when I was a lad, said Ridcully, giving up in the face of the incomprehensible. Spent all the time on a treadmill, round and round, all night long. This is a bit like that, yes?
In very broad terms, said Ponder carefully.
Had an ant farm, too, said Ridcully, thinking faraway thoughts. The little devils never could plough straight.
He pulled himself together.
Anyway, get the rest of your chums here, right now.
What for?
A bit of a tutorial, said Ridcully.
Aren't we going to examine the music?
In good time, said Ridcully. But first, we're going to talk to someone.
Who?
I'm not sure, said Ridcully. We'll know when he turns up. Or her.
Glod looked at their suite. The hotel owners had just left, after going through the, this is the window, it really opens, this is the pump, you get water out of it, with the handle, here, this is me, waiting for some money, routine.
Well, that just about does it. That just about puts the iron helmet on it, that does, he said. We play music with Roxin all evening, and we've got a room that looks like this.
It's homely, said Cliff. Look, trolls don't have much to do with the frills of life.
Glod looked towards his feet.
It's on the floor, and it's soft, he said. Silly me for thinking it was a carpet. Someone fetch me a broom. Now someone fetch me a shovel, then someone fetch me a broom.
It'll do, said Buddy.
He put down his guitar and stretched out on the wooden slab that was apparently one of the beds.
Cliff, said Glod, can I have a word?
He jerked a stubby thumb at the door. They conferred on the landing.
It's getting bad, said Glod.
Yep.
He hardly says a word now when he's not on stage.
Yep.
Ever met a zombie?
I know a golem. Mr. Dorful down in Long Hogmeat.
Him? He's a genuine zombie?
Yep. Got a holy word on his head. I seen it.
Yuck. Really? I buy sausages from him.
Anyway, what about zombies?
You couldn't tell from the taste. I thought he was really a good sausage maker.
What were you saying about zombies?
Funny how you can know someone for years and then find out they've got feet of clay.
Zombies, said Cliff patiently.
What? Oh, yes. I mean, he acts like one.
Glod recalled some of the zombies in Ankh-Morpork, at least like zombies are supposed to act.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And we both know why.
Yeah.
Why? The guitar.
Oh, that, yeah.
When we're on stage, that thing is in charge.
In the silence of the room, the guitar lay in the dark by Buddy's bed, and its strings vibrated gently to the sound of the dwarf's voice.
"Okay, so what do we do about it?"
said Cliff.
"It's made of wood. 10 seconds with an axe, no more problem."
"I'm not sure. That ain't no ordinary instrument."
"He was a nice kid when we met him."
"For a human," said Glod.
"So what do we do? I don't think we could get it off him."
Maybe we could get him to...
The dwarf paused. He was aware of a fuzzy echo to his voice.
That damn thing is listening to us, he hissed. Let's go outside.
They ended up out in the road.
Can't see how it can listen, said Cliff. An instrument's for listening too.
The strings listen, said Glod flatly. This is not an ordinary instrument.
Cliff shrugged.
There's one way we could find out, he said.
Early morning fog filled the streets. Around the university, it was sculpted into curious forms by the slight magical background radiation. Strange-shaped things moved across the damp cobbles. Two of them were Glod and Cliff.
Right,
said the dwarf.
"Here we are."
He looked up at a blank wall.
"I knew it," he said. "Didn't I say magic? How many times have we heard this story? There's a mysterious shop no one's ever seen before, and someone goes in and buys some rusty old curio, and it turns out...
Claude...
Some kind of talisman or a bottle full of genie, and then when there's trouble they go back and the shop,
Claude,
has mysteriously disappeared and gone back to whatever dimension it came from. Yes, what is it?"
"You're on the wrong side of the road. It's over here."
Claude glared back at the blank wall and then turned and stomped across the road.
"It was a mistake anyone could have made."
"Yeah.
It doesn't invalidate anything I said."
Claude rattled the door, and to his surprise found it was unlocked.
"He's gone 2 in the morning. What kind of music shop is open at 2 in the morning?
Claude struck a match. The dusty graveyard of old instruments loomed around them. It looked as though a number of prehistoric animals had been caught in a flash flood and then fossilized.
"What's that one that looks like a serpent?" whispered Cliff.
"It's called a serpent."
Claude was uneasy. He'd spent most of his life as a musician. He hated the sight of dead instruments, and these were dead. They didn't belong to anyone. No one played them. They were like bodies without life, people without souls. Something they had contained had gone. Every one of them represented a musician down on his luck. There was a pool of light in a grove of bassoons. The old lady was deeply asleep in a rocking chair, with a tangle of knitting on her lap and a shawl around her shoulders.
"Claude?"
Claude jumped.
"Yes, what?"
"Why are we here? We know the place exists now."
"Grab some ceiling, hooligans!"
Claude blinked at the crossbow bolt, pricking the end of his nose, and raised his hands. The old lady had gone from asleep to firing stance without apparently passing through any intermediate stage.
"This is the best I can do," he said. "The door wasn't locked, you see, and..."
"So you thought you could rob a poor defenceless old lady?"
"Not at all, not at all. In fact, we...
I belongs to the neighbourhood witch scheme, I do. One word from me and you'll be hopping around looking for some princess with an amphibian fixation."
"I think this has gone far enough," said Cliff.
He reached down and his huge hand closed over the bow. He squeezed. Bits of wood oozed between his fingers.
"We're quite harmless," he said. "We've come about that instrument you sold our friend last week."
"Are you the watch?"
Claude bowed.
"No, ma'am. We're musicians."
"That's supposed to make me feel better, is it? What instrument are you talking about?"
"A kind of guitar."
The old woman put her head on one side. Her eyes narrowed.
"I won't take it back, you know," she said. "It was sold fair and square. Good working condition, too."
"We just want to know where you got it from."
"Never got it from nowhere," said the old lady. "It's always been here. Don't blow that."
Claude nearly dropped the flute he'd nervously picked up from the debris.
"Or we'll be knee-deep in rats," said the old lady.
She turned back to Cliff.
"It's always been here," she repeated.
"It's got a 1 chalked on it," said Claude.
"It's always been here," said the woman, "ever since I had the shop."
"Who brought it in?"
"How should I know? I never asks their name. People don't like that, they just gets the number."
Claude looked at the flute. There was a yellowing tag attached to it, on which the number 431 had been scrawled. He stared along the shelves behind the makeshift counter. There was a pink conch shell. That had a number on it, too. He moistened his lips and reached out.
"If you blow that, you just better have a sacrificial virgin and a big cauldron of breadfruit and turtle meat standing by," said the old lady.
There was a trumpet next to it. It looked amazingly untarnished.
"And this one," he said, "it'll make the world end and the sky fall on me if I give it a tootle, will it?"
"Interesting you should say that," said the old lady.
Claude lowered his hand, and then something else caught his eye.
"Good grief," he said. "Is that still here? I'd forgotten about that."
"What is it?"
said Cliff, and then looked where Claude was pointing.
"That.
We've got some money. Why not?"
"Yeah, it might help. But you know what Buddy said. We'd never be able to find..."
"It's a big city, and if you can't find it in Ankh-Morpork, you can't find it anywhere."
Claude picked up half a drumstick and looked thoughtfully at a gong half buried in a pile of music stands.
"I shouldn't,"
said the old lady.
"Not if you don't want 777 skeletal warriors springing out of the earth."
Glod pointed.
"We'll take this.
$2.
"Hey, why should we pay anything? It's not as though it's yours."
"Pay up," said Cliff with a sigh.
"Don't negotiate."
Glod handed over the money with bad grace, snatched the bag the old lady gave him, and strutted out of the shop.
"Fascinating stock you have here," said Cliff, staring at the gong.
The old lady shrugged.
"My friend's a bit annoyed because he thought you one of those mysterious shops you hear about in folk tales," Cliff went on. "You know, here today, gone tomorrow. He was looking for you on the other side of the..."
"Sounds daft to me," said the old lady,
in a voice to discourage any further unseemly levity. Cliff glanced at the gong again, shrugged and followed Glod. The woman waited until their footsteps had died away in the fog. And then she opened the door and peered up and down the street. Apparently satisfied by its abundance of emptiness, she went back to her counter and reached for a curious lever underneath. Her eyes glowed green for a moment.
"Oh, forget my own head next," she said, and pulled.
There was a grinding of hidden machinery. The shop vanished. A moment later, it reappeared on the other side of the road.